And I will walk around with the microphone, so if you have or would like to engage in a discussion point, please just raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone over. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Tim. Can you hear me? Sounds like you can. Thank you, Tim, for a very nice introduction. So when Tim and I got on the phone recently to talk about my talk, we never really envisioned a presentation, so I don't really have a slideshow for you. Instead, what I'd like to do is talk about social media stuff. I'm very informal. I'm happy to walk around. I'm not a talk show host, but I'm happy to walk around and engage you. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I do. And I encourage you to stop me at any point and ask questions, offer opinions, what have you. I'm actually used to being attacked, so whatever you want to say is fine with me. That's part of the game when you're a journalist, I suppose. But anyway, you got the rundown on my background. I never like to assume that everybody knows what Pharmalot is, so for those of you who do, please bear with me. I'll just give you a quick little introduction. So the site was launched in January 2007 when I worked at the Star Ledger of New Jersey, where I'd already spent a dozen years as a business writer covering the pharma industry. But as you can imagine, for a large consumer audience, as well as a local slash regional business audience, because, you know, some people are one and the same. And after, you know, getting bored writing the same sort of stories in the same limited space, we launched Pharmalot because the internet was taking off and newspapers were going south. The purpose of the site really was to try to harness what was then still the not quite apparent power of the internet for something like a blog. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what a blog is, at least in my mind and experience, because I think that also speaks to some of the social media issues that some of you may grapple with or simply confront on a regular basis. But our plan initially was to simply do what we couldn't do in the newspaper, which was take less space and less time to capture more stories or items of interest, as I call them, on a daily basis. And daily for a while was 8 days a week. It's now dialed back to 5. But the point was really to look at all sorts of things that are of interest to people who work in the pharmaceutical industry, and you know that's from top to bottom, slicing it in different ways, different divisions, different geographies. And then if you think of concentric circles, all the people who work with pharma in some capacity, and they're all shapes and sizes for that as well. And you know this better than I do, all the different sorts of consultants and consulting firms and advisory people and whatnot. And then you have folks who follow pharma for a living, for a work reason. So that's Wall Street, that's Washington, that's managed care, that's academia and advocacy groups, and the list goes on. And then the last ring are consumers, because they have a stake in this and they're the ultimate target customer, if not always the target audience, although social media is bridging that gap now. But I started to say something about blogs. When I got started, you know, the Drudge Report was still a big name. I'm sure it's for some people still a big name, but it was a very prominent name. And it also had a negative connotation, because it was all about Drudge. And the one thing that, and I'd like to extend this, this isn't just about Pharmalot or just about me, but I try, as a journalist, someone with that kind of background and training and education, to extend the same principles to Pharmalot. So the site should not be about me or my opinions. That doesn't mean that I've not put a little zinger in a story now and then, and it doesn't mean that as the only guy in the Pharmalot newsroom who wins and loses all the arguments, because I'm all the editors at once, that my story selection is completely free of, bias isn't the right word, but free of what I think is probably the more interesting and important issues to cover. And I also think that it's important to zig when others zag. And I think that you'll find as blogs, whether I like that term or not, it's still used, blogs will specialize in their strengths. So as the only guy in the newsroom who cannot compete with the realm of regulatory specialists at the Pink Sheet or all the financial reporters at Bloomberg or Reuters, I will try to do other stories that they won't get to. And in doing that over the last few years, Pharmalot's developed an identity. Okay, so that's where we are today. And what I'd like to do a little bit is talk about how I gather stories. And again, along the way, stop and ask me questions, because if you have specific questions that I'm not addressing or something I said, please feel free. I'd like to talk about how I look at social media, how I use social media, how I look at gathering information, because you know, I'm a competitive person. I'm competing with other journalists and other sites, however big or small they are. I want to get to something first, and if I can, I want to do a more interesting job than somebody else. And that's part of my raison d'etre every day. You know, win or lose, that's how I try how to cast myself. So I look at social media as one of many tools. You know, several years ago, it wasn't as prominent for me anymore than you, believe it or not, even though you might think of me as a social media person. You know, Facebook pages from the pharmaceutical industry weren't out there. Twitter was not as popular. In fact, it wasn't until, in my mind, the Mumbai terror attacks in late 2008 that Twitter really took off. So, and by the way, there was a reference earlier to the Boston Marathon. If you didn't know, there were a couple of explosions at the marathon just a little while ago. So that's what Alex was referring to. Anyway, but Twitter really changed things and really stepped up the way that social media zings around and around and around a never-ending, dizzying spin of headlines and links and characters that make it very hard to keep up with. But I'll tell you what I do to try to gather information each day. And again, stop me if you'd like. I'll try to give you an array of different things I look for. I don't pretend to know what each of you do. You're in a whole different world, but we do share certain things in common, obviously. We're both trying to gather a lot of information, the most useful information, often as fast as possible, certainly as thorough as possible, and then pass that along. So in that regard, we do have a lot in common. But again, I don't pretend to know what you know. But I'll give you hopefully some useful insight. And there's no particular order to this, but because I try to appeal to different groups or silos, to use an annoying business term, of all the different possible areas of interest out there, I will look toward regular websites, as I call them, as well as social media. And this could run the gamut from a very useful one to me, actually, are blogs run by attorneys. Whether or not they, whatever their position is, whether they sue the pharmaceutical industry or they defend the pharmaceutical industry, they often will be the first to write something about a new decision. And often they will link to the court ruling, which saves me some time and certainly money, because PACER charges 30 cents a page or something like that. If you're not familiar with PACER, I assume most of you are, but it's the Federal Electronic Court System. And if you go P-A-C-E-R into Google, it pops up, and you can open an account. And all you have to do is give them your credit card number, and you can then, you know, go crazy and have a lot of fun looking for legal documents. It's a treasure chest. It really is a lot of fun. It's very interesting. I try to link as often as possible to documents. I create PDFs, and I link to all that stuff and every story that I think it's pertinent. And is that social media? No, it's using the internet. On the other hand, the blogs that I mentioned, but written by attorneys, would be considered social media. Some of these guys and gals are a lot more insightful than others in their interpretation of the rulings. Others are just trolling for business, very blatantly, as opposed to trying to provide some sort of added value. But that said, I find it useful, and I would imagine you would too. If you're not familiar, which ones? I don't cover patent stuff as much because there's so much patent litigation all the time. Spicy IP is a good one, because that site covers a lot of what goes on in India. And India, as you know, is a real interesting hotbed of intellectual property litigation these days. And they often will provide links to the court rulings. Another one is Drug and Device Law Blog, which, if you're not familiar with it, is run by, well, it used to be two guys, now it's one guy, who works for a firm that defends the pharmaceutical industry. And the writing is very, very amusing, very insightful, sometimes way above my head. But you can always count on lengthy explanations. And as I started to say, lots of links to opinions going back however long. So that's one area of that you might find as a useful resource. That's one way of looking at social media. Another way is Twitter. I follow. How many people here regularly follow multiple times a day, however, you know, Twitter accounts, Twitter feeds from people to get information? Some. Okay. Any particular reason that, and is there a response anyone might want to offer why they're not following people on Twitter?
It's forbidden by our company.
Even on your own personal handheld?
Sorry. John Shu from Gilead. Our corporate public affairs actually forbids that. You can follow, but you don't respond.
But you can follow?
You can follow, but you don't respond.
Okay. Right. So go ahead, John.
May I ask another question quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you about the source. The source meaning direct questions or requests for comments to somebody like, do you know Amy Flood, Vice President of Public Affairs? She made a presentation recently, and she said, I know Ed. He asked me a lot of questions and comments. I respond to maybe half of the questions, but almost nothing for requests for comments.
So your question is? Okay, I'll divert for a second and answer John's question. John's with Gilead, if you don't already know. How do I deal with that? Well, the reality is that I got the bums rush when I was working for a regular old-fashioned conventional newspaper just as often. And I was used to that. You know, it's sort of like cutting your teeth when you're, you know, the Jimmy Olsen in the world. Anybody old enough to remember Jimmy Olsen? Don't raise your hand if you're. I don't want to insult you. But he was one of my role models, but with a shorter haircut. But the reality is that there might be a bias there towards social media, which is really what I think you're getting at. And I think it's their loss. Any company, and I realize that this may not be the function, this may not speak to what a lot of you do. You're not in public affairs or the occasional executive or legal who, you know, gets to meet with someone like me. But it is worth knowing, in my point of view, that any company that fails to engage with media, new media, social media, whatever media, is missing the boat. Because like it or not, I'm there. I'm accessible, and they can't do anything about that. Now, I don't use that as a bully pulpit. I simply use it as I did before. If there's a reason for me to see comment, I will. If they don't, I'll note it. It's their loss. And I understand there's strategic reasons for engaging or not. But I think the key thing is that these websites, and they could be Tumblrs, they could be whatever you want. That's another way of organizing stuff into what looks like a blog. They're there. It's sort of like, imagine 120 years ago, walking down a street in lower Manhattan, unless you were the cop on the beat and you had the right number of gang members with you, there's no way you were going to get some guy with a flyer to get lost. And odds are, that guy with the flyer would just go two blocks over and hand it out there. Same thing today.
A comment I would make about Twitter, I need it curated. I just don't need this stuff raw. I need someone like you, for example, to put it together. I just don't have the time.
To
take these tweets.
Okay.
You know, even to follow good people. I mean,
right.
I don't need 144 characters telling me something. I want to have context.
Okay, and that's a good point. And if you're interested in knowing why I think Twitter is worth considering, and I have the same problem you do, though, so it's six of one, half dozen of the other for me. The bad side of Twitter is if the more people in institutions or organizations you follow, the more Twitter feeds you're going to get all day long. And you've got to then spend time going back an hour, two, 3 hours, say, what did I miss while I was doing my real work? And that's time consuming. And it is tiring to the eyes. On the other hand, it is a very useful monitoring tool and a very useful tool for gathering information, because increasingly more and more people are using that little bit of space to very quickly and efficiently send something around the world to whoever's following them, whether it's 10 people or 10,000 people. And whether I like it or not, I will make a point of following whoever I think is worthwhile, because they're sometimes their opinion or their comment is interesting, but often, just as often or more often, what they're linking to can be very useful.
Do you need help with the lap to move the sides?
Oh.
Oh, you're fine.
Okay. Where am I going here?
Enter. There you go.
Yeah, that's me. You know me already. Sorry. Thank you, Tim. Anyway, so here's the fancy slide. So, but I do think Twitter is useful and it's worth considering, because if you follow a select bunch of institutions or people whose opinions count for what you do, they might put something on there, they might put a link out there that you will find later, or whenever, you don't know, you will find, hey, if I hadn't followed that person or that place, I might have missed that. So it pays to be selective if you're going to tiptoe into that realm. And that kind of brings me to why is the social media important part.
We have a question
here. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to the conversation that I think last week or maybe late a week before, the SEC ruled that public companies could use Twitter to announce public information under Reg FD as long as they told investors ahead of time that they were going to use that and where, you know, like what the feed was. So they could do that instead of a press release or an 8K filing. So now we almost have an obligation to look at the Twitter feed of companies that we're following the news on. I think it was Netflix got in trouble for doing it, and so the SEC made this ruling, and Netflix was the first company to announce that they would be doing that. So there's no standard yet on where the companies are going to announce, you know, that they're using Twitter, but it's a place you have to look.
It's right, it's coming. And not to be too blatantly promotional, and I don't know if I can do it here anyway, but I was in Rockville, Maryland, not quite 2 weeks ago, to meet with a bunch of FDA people, one of whom is Tom Abrams, who heads the Office of Prescription Drug Promotion. This is a formal interview. The Q&A is on Pharmalot today, minus his face. A little technical difficulty with the image. But the long interview is there, and one of the things he said, speaking to your point, is that in response to a question, you know, what do you think of Twitter and the 140 character business? And he said, well, yes, I'm kind of paraphrasing. You're obviously speaking of Twitter here, but that aside, I don't see any particular problem with using 140 characters to convey a message about your medicine, your product. So it's coming, you know, and I think a lot of people were waiting to hear the answer to that question because they just really haven't talked about it much in public yet in a more definitive fashion. So whether we like it or not, the government is making it possible for companies to make use of this technology. And even if it's undefined or later ill-defined or it's debatable what the definition is, it's going to be there. And we're going to need to, and I'm with you on this, we need to follow some of this stuff to make sure that we know what's going on as often as possible. And that's why one reason social media is important, because the barrage is what it is. We have to find a way to filter it to our advantage. So with Twitter, I would say give it some thought, be selective. That's probably, you know, for those who are not familiar with it, that's probably the best way to start. And that's point number two, what data sources can be used, that's one of them. Some of this is social media, some of it isn't. I mentioned the PACER court system. But I did mention legal blogs. There are a lot of different sites, of course, Facebook pages. A lot of those are geared toward consumers. However, one of the reasons I think Facebook is useful, and I would say this also about LinkedIn, which is a very different animal, if you visit enough of these sites often enough, particularly with companies, you can glean competitive intelligence about. Maybe it's clinical trial decisions. Maybe it's personnel changes, other strategic policy moves. That's particularly important with LinkedIn because we're all human. And we might disclose something about our own particular situation that reflects what's going on where we work. I'm not saying you should. I'm just saying people do this, right? And if someone works at, pick a big drug maker. I don't want to pick on anyone, not even Gilead. You know, that's an opportunity to find out information. I do that. I go to all these different places. I mean, obviously, as a journalist, I'm sometimes an in-basket. I can't be everywhere and know everything. I don't have, you know, supersonic hearing, but I have sources. And they say, did you see that? And they'll send me a link. Or they'll leave it to my devices to look something up. Anybody here check Cafe Pharma? Now that got a show of hands. And you know why I'm smiling, right? It's where everyone loves to dish. A lot of it's useless and offensive. And I happen to enjoy a little of both. But because I'm working alone most of the time, and no one can hear me laugh. But in all seriousness, those of you who check Cafe Pharma and know that it can be a useful little listening device. And for those who are not familiar with it, CafePharma.com. It's a very unusual site. It looks old-fashioned. It's a forum. People almost 99% of the time will post something anonymously. I'm one of the few who will put my name and email address there when I'm encouraging people to get in touch. But that aside, it can be a very good listening post because there are people talking about what's happening with clinical trials. Not as much as sales and marketing decisions, obviously, because it's mostly sales reps, but they know stuff that's going on with decisions about the outcomes of clinical trials that you and I may not get to hear about otherwise for a while, if at all, or at least in some level of detail or the way it's described. So that's another good data source, and I would encourage you to put it on your list of places to check periodically, if not on a regular basis. And I started to mention LinkedIn. That's another one. Again, because you can find out on a much higher, more sophisticated level what sorts of changes might be taking place in industry because people are moving around or talking about opportunities coming up.
What about following personal blogs? So, I mean, there's Steve Street at Covance has an invite-only blog. He was formerly at, I think Pfizer in mm-hmm. the UK. Peter Doppert. People who are very tied to pharma, but you know, elect to do this in blog form. I mean, how useful do you find that? And also, how much of that can you kind of bring back as opinion as opposed to, you know, validated or reviewed?
I find, well, it depends upon the cliche, consider the source, comes to mind. It's a very public sort of face, and it may be a very sanctioned sort of public face. So once we understand that, it's a lot easier to say, or hopefully it should be easier to digest what they're putting out there and why. That said, I would never say they're useless. I find them useful. I find that kind of site useful because they do stuff and know stuff that I don't personally. And by extension, we can all relate to that in some way. So that makes it a useful site to visit. John LaMattina, who used to be a Pfizer exec, is another type, but he's not with Pfizer anymore. He's with a VC firm in New England, so he's a little freer to speak his mind and communicate privately if he wants, because he's not with the big behemoth anymore. And but it's a very similar animal, and for that reason, same reason, I find it very useful.
And do you find the affiliated blogs more useful? So like Harvard Business Review has the blog. Going, I mean, is that something you would if it's an attributed or an affiliated blog, is that something that carries a little more weight?
It depends upon the topic. I mean, yeah, if there's something useful, my bottom line is if it's legitimate and it has a useful content that day or however many days, yes, it's just one more information tool. There was one I jumped on however long ago it was. Ray Gilmartin, he used to be the Merck CEO, wrote a couple of guest blogs about being a CEO, which I thought were kind of interesting, a little amusing. And so I did a little write-up on that. There are so many different kinds of blogs out there that I've lost track. To me, you know, they're countless. Wherever you can find them, treasure them. Any other questions before I keep going? Okay. So what potential business use does this information serve? Well, I started to say it could be strategic changes. It could be personnel changes. You can learn about clinical trials. You can learn about interactions with the government. I was doing some sleuthing with the help of a couple of sources last summer and the summer before concerning different drugs sold by the same drug maker And one of these sources turned me on to a very interesting way to get onto the corporate website and find stuff that you wouldn't know is there by going to the corporate website regularly. And obviously, you could put two and two together, and gee, how did one of these sources know to tell this to Ed Silverman? You can figure that out. But this person was very helpful, and I would never have known that. But for those of us information gatherers, I'll align myself with you for a moment, no offense intended. You know, there are very many interesting ways I subsequently learned to get to this one company's corporate website and find clinical trial results that the company really wasn't putting out there, certainly wasn't trying to make an effort to do so, but they were still available. That made it a lot easier for me to work on stories about issues, if you will, effectiveness and safety issues in particular with these drugs, and cite the company's own work from its own website in doing so. It takes time, it takes luck, but that time I had both. But you can too, obviously. And if you take, really make the effort, there are lots of tricks that some company websites apparently have. Again, I'm a rookie compared to the guy who was helping me with this stuff, but it worked. So that's competitive intelligence of a whole different sort, but it wasn't something that you needed a password for, lo and behold.
Ed, I have a question on Cafe Pharma. At Gilead, it's a forbidden site. We cannot access it. And I access it, use my BlackBerry. But the rationale there is contains so much abusive and profane, sometimes, comments about Gilead's executives.
Oh, well.
So yeah, what's your view?
My view, well, I was mostly serious when I chuckled before and said, it doesn't bother me, but it's probably because they're writing about your people, not me. But in all seriousness, you know, you got to take the good with the bad. Yeah, the stuff is offensive. I don't condone it. I'm not saying that's a reason to, I mean, I'm just making light of it right now for the purpose of the conversation. I don't condone it. I don't say that that's a reason to stop and think about it. But if you scrape away all the crap, maybe one out of every three or four comments actually has some useful information. I was on there last week trying to figure something out about one particular company that had yanked the compensation that was packaged, promised sales reps. Big compensation relative to their regular salaries. And there are a few complaints, and I'm still trying to follow it up because the information I got, I partly corroborated it. If I finished, I would have put it on the site already. But that's real. Every so often, there are memos that people will reproduce. And those are helpful. And they don't always talk about the obvious sorts of HR issues. They're talking about stuff that affects their relationships with government contracts, managed care, pricing issues. So you have to piece it together. You have to be patient. And sometimes it's a waste of time, I admit. And if you have a low tolerance for the offensive stuff, yeah, stay away. But, you know, we all have to stomach some of that sometimes. Okay. Any other questions? No. Okay. So I YouTube, it's on my little chart here, a slide rather. YouTube can be interesting. It's really hunt and peck in ways that Cafe Pharma may not be. But more than once, I have found an example of a YouTube video posted by someone at a company who should not have done so. In fact, I found one, I can't remember which company it was, I should, but it was about 12 to 18 months ago, just about the time the FDA issued a warning letter that mentioned this particular video, because it had stuff in there that shouldn't have been in a video on YouTube. It helps to have sources, but if you learn to use keywords, and I think that the use of keywords is very crucial to find things, so whether it's Google or YouTube or any other site, keywords can actually turn up a gold mine. Again, it's hunt and peck, but I get paid to find, one of the things I get paid to do is find stuff, as I put it, and there are different ways of doing it. Sometimes you have to have patience, but YouTube can be useful that way. I'm not really sure how useful it is beyond finding, you know, an interesting video. It depends what the content of the video is, obviously. Most of the time, these are promotional messages. There's nothing terribly revealing unless they're mistakes, as I mentioned with this one example. And finding the right fit. There are different categories or buckets in which you can put some of this stuff. We mentioned competitive intelligence is one. There's also pharmacovigilance. And, you know, safety is such a hot topic, and it's such a bugaboo with social media. When I was in Maryland talking to Tom Abrams, I said, well, you're going to be putting out this guidance. What can you say about the issue of adverse events and how that's going to be handled? And he said, well, it's really not me. It's Gerald Delpan in the other office. So it's not what they're doing with adverse events and social media will not be folded into the social media guidance coming out next. Well, it could come out this year, but probably not until July 2014. But the FDA is still grappling, obviously, with the whole issue of what to do with safety and adverse events, how to report that, how to deal with that. And then what do you do with that information when you're inside a pharma company? No, I don't have any great insights into that because my interview was with Abrams, not Gerald Delpan. But obviously, social media is going to be a very, very closely tracked topic. What Abrams did say was, for example, with third-party websites, if you have a Facebook page and someone else likes, let's say you're a company, you have a Facebook page for a product and someone else likes something and leaves an unhelpful comment about the product or something worse, the FDA seems to understand that that's not something that the company promoted. And is different from what the company might do in promoting or leaving comments of its own on its own Facebook page. So they're clearly trying to make distinctions and build comfort levels about that. But it doesn't mean it's going to get easier to go ahead and monitor that sort of information. And then what do you do about whether you leave it up there or delete it? So a lot of these things are still being worked out. If they weren't being worked out, we'd have the guidance already.
And with the pharmacovigilance being so closely regulated, is that something that companies are obligated to somehow follow? And right now there's pretty tight, at least from the information manager's perspective, a pretty tight and finite set of data sets that, you know, it could be, you know, big or small, growing and not. And then there's pharmacovigilance teams that are a little bit broader than just the information managers. But is this something that, you know, if something is reported on a website as opposed to, you know, cited in an article, I mean, how serious should this be taken? And, I mean, how do you then consider the source?
Well, I think there are different levels, if you will, of what would constitute an action by a company if it gets wind of an adverse event or a safety issue. So I think that nothing really will change about that from today till next year. I think that the FDA will maintain that posture, but I think that there will be more official onus once the guidance is released, of course. I mean, there'll be a comment period, there'll be a draft, but we're headed toward a time where we're going to have official requirements, obviously. So I think pharmacovigilance is going to be, they're going to try to make it more delineated, but so that companies have some latitude to know what to do, when to do it, but it's not like it's going to go away or get easier. I still think that companies are going to have an obligation to track things. But by the same token, I think companies need the information that legal will use to tell marketing what to do and tell public affairs what to do is going to lessen because, well, not lesson, maybe that's the right word. But I think legal is going to be forced to backpedal a little bit or find different ways to say what it says now and allow a little bit more leeway for companies to deal with the public on social media. But specifically with safety information.
So, Ed, this is a true story. How many of you, I don't know, remember, but YS used to be part of American Home Products.
Yes.
And we had a Whitehall laboratories, which you remember, right? So somebody decided to respond to a listserv where a librarian, New York Academy of Science, wrote something about, she did a search, it was a hot topic, ibuprofen and wound-eating bacteria. You know, we're going back more than 20 years.
Wood-eating bacteria?
Wound-eating bacteria.
Oh, wound-eating, okay.
Wound,
W-E-N. I thought you were going to talk about the pallets in which they ship the product.
Not mad cow disease, but anyway. So she saw it, got indignant, and did her own searches and responded to that listserv. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
She was almost fired. So the executives, what they told her is that you may monitor, but you don't respond.
And so you want to know what I think, right? Well, if I were a lawyer, and I'm not, as the lawyers would say, I'm just a journalist. I would understand that point of view, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best position to take. I guess you're wondering, I mean, John brought this up for a reason. What if I did that? Or what if I considered doing that? What should happen to me? Again, I don't pretend to know what legal would say about that, but I do think it goes beyond legal to informing corporate policy about how to deal with the internet and how to deal with social media. It's a listserv. It could be a comment on a blog. It could be a response to a tweet. Really, these are just all mechanisms, right? Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. Well, I really think we've gotten past that now a few decades later. The message is the message. And I'm not trying to be smarter than McLuhan, but I really do live that every day. And I think that if one of you were in the position John just described, I think the argument should be made, certainly for the purposes of discussion, if not saving your job, that there's an obligation to provide information that's accurate so that the ultimate end user, maybe this was other researchers or the public, has the correct information. And if you're in the information business, you want to be delivering correct and useful information. And if the company doesn't have a policy toward all these different situations, which now many of them do, or certainly all the big ones do, that doesn't mean that every single variable is going to be covered. For the same reason that Tom Abrams says, when the draft guidance comes out, it's really going beyond, hopefully, with the name of a familiar platform, Twitter, Facebook, what have you, because really the technology is moving so quickly. So it's a question really of stepping back and more broadly saying, how do we deal with disseminating information properly when we need to, instead of allowing a vacuum to be created? Because of course the flip side is, if you don't respond with something useful and appropriate, someone else might, probably will, and it may not be useful and appropriate. And that could be to the detriment of the company, hence part of your argument in defending yourself. Okay.
Oops.
I hope I answered your question.
Yes. So for as much, I'm not in big pharma anymore.
Okay.
But so I can understand the company saying, I don't want you looking at YouTube. I don't want you going to cafe on company time. But I would hope, and I would think probably at this point, someone in the company, if not you, someone in corporate communications or in public affairs or someone, should be looking at these sites to see what's being said about them and their products. You know, they may not want you to poke on there during company time, but that's different from using those sites to find out what's going on around you.
Yes, I agree. And I think if you're in a part of the company when you've got to play vacuum to an extent, human vacuum, to see what's going on out there, and you should also be able to pass it along efficiently. And maybe one or two people can do just so much, but maybe it's sort of like news judgment. What if you're in that department in whatever company and you have a colleague or two colleagues, but one of them's out or there's just so much going on? It's going to be, I believe, likely, because humans are who we are, that we're going to miss something or have a different judgment about what something represents. and therefore maybe it doesn't get passed along when it could or should. And so I think it's important to create a framework. I'm not saying I have a suggestion because I'm not inside a big pharma, but I think it's important to create a framework to allow people like you and others who you work with to have the opportunity to make it possible to say, okay, we're going to scan the universe. We're going to set up ways to do this and then make efficient use of the information we have so we can figure out where to send it. And if we're not letting people do that, other people do that inside our company. There should be people designated in each department or division so that they can pass along something because they're going to have a different perspective. You know, if you're in a huge pharma company and you're a scientist or you're working in biologics or you're someone who's working in managed care, you're going to have a very different perspective on when you see something going around. It's really easy to set up, you know, Google alerts, and the equivalent of, you know, the old press clip machine that would send 25 stories in someone's mailbox. That's simple. But you're not getting a way to interpret that and make use of it. And you're not tailoring it to those who may have a need to do more with it that they wouldn't know about otherwise. So I agree with you, and I think it really has got to go beyond that. It's got to be more sophisticated. Because if companies believe what they say, that intelligence is important, they've got to find a way to gather it correctly and make use of it correctly and not be afraid. As far as the policy of not letting people look on their own time, designate people, again, in different departments. That's the best way to get the different perspectives and make sure you don't miss as, you know, or you get as much as you can without missing too much. Again, this is a journalist talking. You could say I have a vested interest. I want people to read as much as they can and pass along as much as they can, and I do. But what I'm talking about right now doesn't really affect what I do on a regular basis.
And how do the sources get disseminated to the information manager? I mean, is there a shared resource? How do the corporate pharma librarians or the corporate pharma information managers really distill through all the noise to get to the key sources?
Well, most of the people here probably know this better than I do. I'm assuming to an extent that you do some of the same things that I do. And you make use of your favorite sites. And again, I'm not a corporate librarian, but try to do what I do every day. Keep a list of the best sites that you find useful and make sure you're flagging things. One way is Google Alerts. How many people here use Google Alerts? Most of you do. Okay, if you don't, set it up, use keywords. You got to be prepared though. It's sort of like Twitter. You're going to get a ton of these things emailed to you or sent to you on your handheld if you set it up that way all week long the rest of your life until you make them disappear. So you're going to be inundated with this stuff. So be prepared. But you can tailor it. That said, it is very useful, and you will get stuff sent to you. So it's a lot easier. You know, it's pushed toward you instead of pulling in toward you, right?
Yeah, my question was really related. I mean, you tell us about being a journalist. So, do you work what comes up, what's cool today, or do you have leads and you follow them? Because it's very different to me to go search for something. So right. Then I will go into the dirty, murky world of Cafe Pharma. If I have a question, I will not go to it in preference. Update of myself.
That's just one resource. I mean, I've been covering the pharmaceutical industry since 1995. And what I generally say, I live in my own world, but the other reality is I live in New Jersey, where a lot of the drug makers are based. And they're all around me, even after all the layoffs. So I get to meet people. And through going to places more formally like this since 1995, I've swapped a lot of business cards and emails and phone numbers, so I have sources. And people will come to me. Now, often people will come to me, you could say they're disgruntled, blah, blah, blah. Well, maybe they are, but you know what? I often find they have a higher cause. They may have a vested interest. Maybe they're a whistleblower with a False Claims Act lawsuit, or maybe they're just ticked off. But that kind of source is a lot more valuable than Cafe Pharma because it's firsthand that I'm not trying to fish through the crap to see what's real and what's not. I, as a journalist, unlike someone who does what you folks do, I'm assuming, you know, your function is different. Yeah, I'm looking for stuff that's topical and timely. You know, tomorrow morning, FDA commissioner is going to be testifying in Congress about compounding pharmacies. It's sort of a no-brainer to put something on my site to remind people, with, and with a link if they want to go watch it, you know, happening live and some background. But I'm also out there doing other things. If I have enough time, I interviewed a Wall Street analyst the other day about a stock that is of interest, maybe not hot to everybody, but it's an interesting story, and it's a theme I've followed on and off for many years. So I'm going to do a little update with context, including comments from this guy. I went out there myself based on working off of something that happened last week. So there are different ways of doing it. So it is an old-fashioned, you know, can't say shoe leather so much because I'm using a laptop, but it's different. So I'm not endorsing Cafe Pharma. I just happen to mention it because it's interesting. Right. Well, you know, I do a little of both every day. I might decide or remember or see that something is topical because it's mentioned somewhere else or someone mentioned it to me, and then I'll go out looking. I'll go to my favorite sites. I just do a ton of Google searches, a ton of those things, and it's remarkable how easy it's made my life. Although it gets more complicated when you get a lot of, you know, blind alleyways and, you know, the keywords aren't quite correct, but it's a good way of doing it. Other times, yeah. So I'm working on something, but I'm really going out there to see, is there really something there, or I'm interested in something. What can I do to make that different? What kind of information can I gather and distill and build on to see, you know, if there's a good story there or not, as opposed to just sort of moving with something that comes to me, as simple as a press release.
Question about your editorial process. I just read your Abrams piece, as usual, very informative, a lot of golden nuggets, but it's an interview. So do you tape the FDA and then type up the transcript, send it back to him for comments and revise? So how do you do that?
Okay. There are probably three typos at least that I didn't get to fix because I had to drive down here. So yes, I taped and transcribed it. The typos are testimony to that. My process generally when I interview people, if I'm doing it by phone, until the arthritis kicks in, I type as fast as possible. And, you know, it's a lot easier. But something like that where I get a chance to do face-to-face and I know I have this much time and they're going to deliberately talk as fast as possible, and I know when that's going to happen because they're using me for a particular reason, right? I'll bring the tape recorder. So I brought a tape recorder, I transcribe it. Now the other point, do I send it back to them? No, if I have a question, I get asked that in advance sometimes, can I see it? Because I run a lot of Q&As. And I'm uncomfortable giving the entire thing to somebody because every so often you get someone who is either a control freak or nervous for some other reason, and they have that right. But I'm a little uncomfortable giving them what amounts to editorials say. So I will send them portions to make sure I got something correct, particularly if I'm listening and typing. By tape, what you saw in the Tom Abrams interview, I excerpted maybe, you know, three or four exchanges because it was either repetitive or off in a different direction. So that it wasn't for space. But that's my procedure generally.
Are there any last questions? We'll be wrapping up shortly. So any last questions?
I have time.
I want to ask about another social construct, not social media perhaps, but cell phones on the train. So these days, you're sitting on the train and you overhear a conversation. What do you do with that information?
Use it. No.
An instance where there was an HR discussion going on about a pharma company, and I think with three words, like a person's first name, the destination, and pharma company, I knew exactly who and what they were talking about. But what do you do with that information then?
I've been in that situation in bars, more than trains, and Little League field as well. I mentioned I live in New Jersey. Well, over the years, I run into people, you know, my kids have played with kids whose parents are in pharma, and I even have relatives who are in pharma. Don't see them very often. But I can tell you a real story. There was, I didn't know this person who worked at USA Today, but this is probably in the 80s, before we had lots of cell phones and the internet. But she was at a bar, I don't know, Gramercy Park, it was in Manhattan, and she overheard some people talking about an upcoming IPO announcement. This wasn't insider trading. It was like, you know, they're going to do something of that sort. It wasn't insider trading. It was just a scoop on a company planning to go public. But one guy clearly knew so much. So she went back, called whoever it was in public relations, and said, I want to comment, and just read back every single detail. And if they denied it, they'd be lying, particularly since it was so imminent. So they have a credibility issue if they want to lie outright to someone within the same week that the information is going out. So they simply declined to comment, and she had a good story. She had a scoop. Now, I have sat on trains where people are talking or on a cell phone, and I've heard snippets of things. I've been on Little League fields, I started to say, where you know, people don't know I'm around, and I'm sitting there innocently trying to decompress and avoid work, and it hits me in the face. And so I remember it. Now I will take out my own cell phone and write a note to myself and work, you know, and follow that up. It's legitimate if you can verify it, and you know, you don't have to get anybody in trouble. I mean, if I want to introduce myself to somebody after I've overheard that, it's my risk. You know, they can tell me to screw off or worse, or just flee in panic, or both. But it's fair game. You know, all's fair in love and war, so long as you know you don't violate any laws or principles.
I just have to add an anecdote that I've flown many times from Delhi to Chandigarh, and that is basically an all-pharma flight with every conceivable company, and I couldn't believe what was being shared on that flight. I mean, I felt very guilty being on that flight.
But you paid.
I mean, it was big company X sitting on a 40-minute flight with big company Y going, how do you guys do this? No, we do it completely different. It's like, I mean, it was way better than the train. It was amazing. much more disclosure than would ever come in this room.
It's an old-fashioned form of social media, right? It's just social.
Yeah, I'm stuck on a flight. Are there any other questions or comments for Red? With that, I'd like to give him a big round of applause and thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll turn it over to Alex for closing statements.
So just final comment, rest of time between now and 6 o'clock. If you're going to the Monday night event, meet downstairs in the lobby of the Hyatt at 6 o'clock. It does say 6:15 in the book. I was talking with Karen, who's coordinating this. She'd like everybody there at 6 o'clock because there's going to be a lot of people. We have roughly 200 people that are going on the boat. And based on the number of groups that are going, we don't want to run the risk of people missing the boat because unlike other past events, if you miss the boat, unless you're planning on getting wet, you're probably not getting on. So 6 o'clock. Inside. The question was asked, are we going to be inside or outside the boat? We will be inside the boat if you want. There's a top level as well. I don't know if we have access to that, but we will be inside.